This is a recording of the talk titled Misrepresentations of Te Tiriti in Law and Policy, the TPB, the RMA and Everything in Between, by Senior Lecturer in the Law Faculty at Te Heranga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, Luke Fitzmaurice Brown, at Te Pātakatoe Adam Art Gallery on the 25th of March 2026. This talk was the final in a four-part series, Kōrero Pono Mai, Talks on Te Tiriti and the Treaty, that ran in conjunction with the exhibition Whai Wahi. We join the recording with co-curator Brooke Poe introducing Fitzmaurice Brown and the series co-papa.
Kia ora koutou. Thank you for joining us for the last of the Kōrero Pono Mai talks on Te Tiriti. My name is Brooke Poe. I co-curated this exhibition, Whai Wahi, with Abby Kinnane. This lunchtime lecture series, Kōrero Pono Mai, runs alongside Whai Wahi and takes heed from Te Waka Hauora and their redaction of Te Papa's treaty panel. We called it Kōrero Pono Mai in reference to their call on Te Papa and other institutions to tell the truth. This week, we're welcoming Dr. Luke Fitzmaurice Brown. Thank you for joining us for your lecture on misrepresentations of Te Tiriti in law and policy. And just join me in thanking Luke.
Kia ora koutou. Ko Luke Fitzmaurice Brown tōku ingoa, he uri tēnei nō Te Au Pauri. My name's Luke, whakapapa to Te Au Pauri, up in the far north centre of Aotearoa, the true centre. And I work here at Vic, mostly down at the law faculty, teaching Te Tiriti, family law, a few other bits and bobs, but then occasionally up here at Kawa Maui as well, just hanging out there, which is nice. So I thought today I would go through a little bit about how our current state for Te Tiriti in law and policy came to be. And if I see your eyes glazing over about law and policy, I will try to take heed of that. I'll try to not get too deep in the weeds. But I think it's not always well understood that even though we hear a lot more about Te Tiriti or Waitangi nowadays and its reference in legislation, and it's certainly considerably different, a different landscape to how it was 50 years ago, the vast majority of the time, those references and mentions of Te Tiriti and attempts to include Te Tiriti or mention it are not true reflections of what Te Tiriti or Waitangi actually says. And so it's kind of drawing on that theme from the Te Waka Hauora statement, exhibition, action at Te Papa, a little bit of asking how we might both highlight that more often and then move beyond it. Because I think we've come a long way, realistically, in how Te Tiriti is referenced in our laws and in our policies and the extent to which it's upheld. But I also think we've got a very long way to go. So that's the aim of what I thought I'd talk about today. And I'll tell a couple of stories along the way. Kei te poi. So this guy, that's James Prendergast. And he was the famous judge who in 1877 said that the treaty is a simple nullity in a court case called the Wiparata case, commonly known as today, where Wiparata, Ngāti Toa Rangatira, had sought to have land that was gifted to the Crown for the purpose of building a school given back to the iwi when that school was never built, and that did not happen. And part of the basis for that claim of please return this land that was gifted to you for a particular purpose was that under Te Tiriti o Waitangi, Māori are guaranteed tino rangatiratanga over our whenua. And James Prendergast, in a now famous statement, said that that just holds no legal weight whatsoever anymore. This was not the case immediately after the signing of Te Tiriti, but by 1877, this became the kind of emblematic statement from the courts as to the legal status of Te Tiriti and how much it mattered. And this remained the law for a very long time, and in some ways still kind of does remain the law. Because 70-ish years later, 63 years later, we had another case, famous case, This is Hoani Te Huhu Tukino, the sixth rangatira from Ngāti Tuwharitoa. And in 1940, he made a similar kind of argument. There's a whole background to how this came before the court. But basically, his kaupapa was to go to the highest court that we had at the time, which was still the Privy Council over in London, and say that what was happening can't happen because of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. The treaty, Te Tiriti, has these legal obligations on the government, on the Crown, and on organisations who are operating under the authority of the Crown. And so 100 years after Te Tiriti was signed, the Privy Council heard that case, and they said, no, sorry, we can't uphold the legal status of Te Tiriti, or it has no legal status, more accurately. In and of itself, Te Tiriti o Waitangi does not bind the Crown, does not bind the New Zealand government. It is not a legally binding document, essentially, which sounds terrible and is terrible. And we've come some way from that, but not as far as we think. Because what the Privy Council was saying here is that the treaty can have legal teeth if you put it in other legislation. So on its own, it doesn't do much, which is terrible. The most positive interpretation of that is that yes, it can have weight when you put it into other laws. Parliament passes a piece of legislation, that will have legal force. But Te Tiriti itself doesn't. And this is still the law today. So this is our legal status for Te Tiriti. This is our constitutional status for Te Tiriti. A court would could reach the same interpretation, which is bad, in my opinion. But how we've got around that, for better or worse, is this 50-year story now of referencing Te Tiriti o Waitangi in the law. So this is Maturata, and in 1975, he was the driving force behind the creation of the Waitangi Tribunal, created by the Treaty of Waitangi Act. And what the Treaty of Waitangi Act said when it was brought in, apart from setting up all the architecture of the tribunal, which was great, was that the purpose of the tribunal and of this law, the Treaty of Waitangi Act, was to provide for the observance and confirmation of the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. So here, and from this point onwards, we had a number of references and an increasing number of references to the treaty in our laws. But that phrase, the principles, has been the core kind of center point of all of those references ever since. And this is from the Act as well. I won't read it all in full, but a key part of why the principles are mentioned in legislation instead of just on a Te Tiriti is based on this idea that there are two versions of Te Tiriti and we can't possibly know which one was the right one or what the intent of the signatories was. And that myth, I think, is behind a lot of the protest and advocacy that you see nowadays and historically. It's not for me to say for sure, but I think frustration about that myth was a key part of the Te Waka Haurua action in Te Papa. So this was a great milestone. We now have the treaty and the law. We now have the Waitangi Tribunal. They've done some great work since. And it shifted us away. It shifted us well away from this simple nullity idea from 100 years prior. But in doing so, it created this kind of compromise where most laws since say principles. And most laws since rely on this myth and this compromise that we have two versions of the treaty and we don't know which is which. This is David Lange. Many of you may recognize this person. And his photo's on the screen because in 1986, as his government started to sell off state-owned enterprises, we had the courts enter the fray for the first time in a major way to weigh in on what treaty principles are in their view. As the government went to sell state-owned enterprises, there were a number of Māori who were concerned that the sale widespread sale of Crown assets would undermine what they hoped was about to start, which was a treaty settlement era, which then subsequently did start. The Waitangi Tribunal had been given the power to look at historical claims only a year earlier, so it felt like this kind of new dawn of historical accountability. And then, from the perspective of many Māori, the government were about to sell everything that we could potentially claim back in kind of lieu of all of the treaty breaches that were about to be uncovered by the Waitangi Tribunal. So in response, as a kind of compromise to that, the State-Owned Enterprises Act had this clause inserted that said nothing in this act shall permit the Crown to act in a manner that is inconsistent with the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. And this, when state-owned assets were subsequently sold off, very shortly afterwards, became the central focus of a claim by the New Zealand Māori Council to the courts to say you can't do this because you've breached this provision about the principles of the treaty. And that led the court and the Court of Appeal in that case, which was the highest New Zealand court at the time, to say, okay, cool, you've given us this direction, Parliament, to uphold the principles. What are those principles? And the courts subsequently have done that now for 40 years. Again, this was a milestone. The courts treating, like, they gave this a lot of weight. The gravity of the exercise of saying, okay, we're doing treaty principles now, was a big deal for the courts. This is Iritai Hakurei jury. He was the chief judge of the Māori Land Court at the time and the chair of the Waitangi Tribunal at the time. Really significant figure in Māori legal history. He described it 2 years after that case that I've just referred to, that until the Court of Appeal decision, which halted the transfer of assets to state-owned enterprises, Māori people had not won a case since 1847. You had a sort of judicial scoreboard, settlers 60, Māori 1. This is an authoritative voice, if not one of the most authoritative voices, on treaty law, highlighting how much of a milestone this was and how much of a positive development it was for Māori and for New Zealand, really, that we finally had judicial recognition of the treaty. But, and it's of course with great, great respect to rangatira like Irijuri, it's still not what Te Tiriti says. We are still having this approach based on the principles, based on this myth that we have two versions of this document and we don't possibly know what was intended. Where from a Māori perspective, it's quite obvious what was intended. Tino rangatiratanga was asserted and protected in Te Tiriti o Waitangi and all else flows from there. So we have this, this has been the foundation, and in some ways it's been a really pragmatic way forward to advance treaty rights, Māori rights, treaty jurisprudence. And in other ways, it's quite a shaky foundation because of the untruths that it is based upon, which were really widespread at the time. And I understand the need for pragmatism and to get laws through Parliament and all of those things. Like, maybe this had its place, but this pattern has persisted. So we see in examples like the Resource Management Act, another really important piece of legislation, Te Tiriti just says tino rangatiratanga over whenua. That's really all you need to know, or the starting point for Māori land rights. Instead of that, we have this statement that anyone exercising power under the Resource Management Act, our most important resource management law, arguably our most important environmental law, shall take into account the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, brackets, Te Tiriti or Waitangi. This was quite an early major example of this new era of laws referencing the treaty, but it continued. This is the Oranga Tamariki Act. It says 1989, it was actually passed in 2017. It's confusing, there's a history to that. But this is a much more recent law, since repealed. It relates to child protection and whānau. The key part there in the treaty, in Te Tiriti, is tino rangatiratanga over kāinga. Tribunal have said that that's this all-encompassing guarantee of cultural continuity for Māori, which has major implications for child protection. Instead of that, we get policies and practices should aim to reduce disparities for Māori. These are all just summaries of what was in the Act. Policies and practices should uphold these tikanga principles, mana te maiti, whakapapa whanaungatanga. Oranga tamariki should seek to develop partnerships with iwi, and oranga tamariki should publicly report on progress. This is a much, this is a good reflection of what a modern treaty clause tends to look like. It's much more detailed and elaborate and specific than the one in the RMA, which is just a general uphold the treaty, except it doesn't quite say that. It says don't do anything that would not uphold the principles. Rather than these broad, all-encompassing clauses, we have these much more specific clauses that are much more common. It's not that specificity is bad, it's that this falls short of what Te Tiriti says. So seek to develop partnerships is not true partnership. That's the Crown still holding all the levers of power as to when and how these partnerships occur. Reducing disparities is not the same, and the Waitangi Tribunal commented on this, as just not taking Māori children into state care and reducing the need for that entirely. And I get that child protection is complicated. Strong views on that. That can be a whole nother lecture. All of these still, in my view, were a positive advance on what the old child protection law, the Children, Young Person and Their Families Act, said before 2017. But all of it is still not tēnō rangatiratanga over kāinga. And tēnō rangatiratanga over taonga, our other really central term in Te Tiriti, for example, Te Reo Māori is a taonga, and we don't need to look too far for examples of policies in the last few years which have failed to uphold that guarantee. One of the reasons I think we need to revisit some of these original premises, foundations for our treaty laws is because that shaky foundation is quite easily exploited. And I think we've seen this come to fruit for the first time in a major way in the last couple of years. So this is the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi Bill that the ACT Party proposed. It's a fiction. It said, let's clarify what these principles are. Now, firstly, courts like interpret legislation all the time. That's not actually that controversial. However, even with that, like, it's not the end of the world to want to clarify what Te Tiriti means in our laws and policies. I think that's a good idea. I don't agree with David Seymour. But it's not a bad idea to seek clarity and seek accuracy and seek truth if we're seeking to achieve treaty justice. But that's not what this does. These three principles, which were the central point, this is from the explanatory note of the Treaty Principles Bill, said we need greater certainty and clarity. We need a national conversation about the place of the principles in our constitution. Agree. We need a more robust and widely understood conception of New Zealand's constitutional arrangements. Agree. And we need to build consensus around the treaty / Te Tiriti in a way that will promote greater legitimacy and social cohesion. All correct. Every point, I would agree with that. David Seymour, like a broken clock's right twice a day, right? But all of this, I would agree with. The problem with the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi Bill, it was just all a falsification. None of that was a reflection of what Te Tiriti or Waitangi actually said, and its goal was to erase Te Tiriti from our laws and policies, not clarify it. It was such a transparent attempt to do that that almost all of us saw through that. And it was very heartening to see so many people oppose the Treaty Principles Bill, whether that be through submissions to Parliament in record numbers or the hikoi or any number of other actions. But I think it illustrates in this exercise of like, oh, we just need clarity, illustrates the problem with the shaky foundation that some of our treaty jurisprudence is built upon. And again, there was room, I could see how the pragmatic case for treaty principles could be made in the 1970s and 80s. And in all of these moments where some progress was better than none, and I could see how principled people could still make those compromises. I just think we now need to revisit some of those. There have been attempts over the years to solve this type of problem, to further advance, even from those who would say, okay, we took a step, it was a compromise step, but it was necessary at the time, let's now take the next step. There's a very kind of good faith version of that argument, right? If we go back to the Resource Management Act, which was one of our major treaty provisions in the law, this was updated briefly, then repealed, in another piece of legislation called the Natural and Built Environments Act. And rather than take into account the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, brackets, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, we then got give effect to the principles of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. This is better. Give effect is much better than take into account. It assumes, in the absence of all other things, that your job is to give effect, is to make this thing happen. It creates a momentum in the legislation, which if you have a really good reason not to, you can still weigh that up against other things. But take into account is take into account any number of things, any of which could trump Te Tiriti in that moment. This gets us closer to an active obligation to give effect to Te Tiriti. We still have principles here, but we just have Te Tiriti, not Te Tiriti slash the treaty. I'm not convinced that convention of using both is actually that useful anymore. I think it kind of gives too much weight to the English text, that by somehow switching languages, we change the meaning of the document, where we could all be speaking in French or Spanish and it wouldn't change the historical reality of what Te Tiriti actually says. So the convention to say Te Tiriti slash the treaty to highlight that Te Tiriti exists, I get that that's useful, but I sometimes wonder whether we overemphasize the value of that. That's a whole aside, sorry. We've still got the principles in this. That means we're still making that compromise. Honestly, having said all of this about the principles being an unprincipled compromise, it's not that I'm against a principled approach. We need that to apply Te Tiriti to our modern circumstances. It's just the principles as a specific construct are based on a myth. So we need to unpack that. So this is one way. It's not treaty justice, but it is better. And this piece of legislation had a whole bunch of other things around te oranga o te taiao, the health of the environment, being much more thoroughly upheld through this legislation than its predecessor. It got us way closer. It just didn't get us all the way. And it's now gone. So the Natural and Built Environments Act was in force for, I think, months before the government repealed it, reinstated the Resource Management Act temporarily, and have now proposed a new law which would once again repeal the Resource Management Act and replace it with a law that doesn't have an overarching treaty clause at all. So it was kind of one step forward, another step forward, a step back, and then about 100 steps back, which is on the horizon. The other thing I think this way of evolving the treaty conversation in law compromises us is that when these repeals and these attempts at getting rid of all these laws have subsequently taken place, those of us who want treaty justice and advocate for Te Tiriti in its fullness to be upheld, all of a sudden have to figure out whether we put our time and energy into defending these compromised provisions, which we know aren't treaty justice. So on the Oranga Tamariki Act 5 years ago, a treaty activist, advocate, scholar, anyone, the Waitangi Tribunal weighed in on this, would have said all these 4 points fall short of fully upholding Te Tiriti in different ways. Because compared to the guarantee of Tino Rangatiratanga, that doesn't reach that standard. Then the government went to repeal this provision, and all of a sudden, all of us said, oh no, don't do that. And I was in this category, and it kind of, you go around in circles, because this thing which you criticized for being this poor reflection of treaty justice is all of a sudden kind of better than nothing. And so we find ourselves defending all of these very half-ass compromises, to be frank, where we don't want them to get rid of this, we don't want them to get rid of that. Other things like the Marine and Coastal Area Act, the foreshore and seabed, hugely compromised, the product of a compromise between the Māori Party and the government at the time, still represented a stripping of Māori rights. And then this government went to repeal it, and we said, no, please don't do that. The same is true of the treaty settlement process, which provides a tiny measure of justice, but not enough. If they got rid of that, would say, oh, it's better than nothing, please don't do that. We end up defending these things and being not necessarily on the back foot, I think that's too combative, but having to defend things which are not the goal. I mean, that's politics, maybe that's social change, like you have periods of advancement and then you defend the gains that you've got even though they're not what you wanted in fullness. But it's just an interesting, I think, reflection of the current moment that some of us don't quite know what to do about this. Do we put all this time and energy into, like, treaty principles bill? Treaty principles themselves are major compromises. 300,000 of us were mobilized to make a submission on the treaty principles bill, rightly, I think, because the alternative was way worse in that case. But I would hate for the majority of those 300,000 to think that it's finished, because the thing we all defended, treaty principles, like, they suck most of the time, much of the time. Sometimes they get us further, but they're this compromise in a number of respects. So I mean, I think indefensible on the screen is maybe too strong a word. I have a lot of time for the people who fought these fights over decades at times and brought treaty rights back from oblivion to what we have now. Those, I think, we can acknowledge as important advances. But the current moment gets us to defend those in a way that I worry makes us lose sight of that horizon that we need to be aiming towards. How do we kōrero pono mai? How do we tell the truth? This is not a question I have the answers to. I think these are some suggestions, but I think it is incumbent on each of us to try to figure out what this means in all of our contexts, and that's why I think the provocation of Te Waka Hauora is really important. There's still this need to educate people about what Te Tiriti o Waitangi actually says. We were still raised on misconceptions and myths. All of us. I think sometimes I speak to some of my students, and our parents and grandparents kind of assume that anyone coming to university nowadays grew up on an accurate telling riti in school, and that's not usually true. We still have an education system in a country which tells ourselves myths like we have the best race relations in the world, and at least we have the treaty. It's true that at least we have the treaty, but we still have work to do there more broadly. Challenging orthodox legal interpretations is kind of in the weeds a bit for the lawyers, but there are still attempts to overturn that 1940 Privy Council decision, which said the treaty itself is not legally enforceable. In the meantime, we've kind of just shown that it is. I think the crisis that would have happened if the Treaty Principles Bill had passed is that the Supreme Court would have gone, well, you've passed a law saying that's what the treaty says, but it doesn't, so we're not going to uphold that. And there were warnings of that from constitutional experts, and I would suspect, like, the Treaty Principles Bill was just farcical. It tried to legislate a falsehood. Generally, Parliament can legislate whatever it wants, and the courts are bound to follow that. I think in this case, the courts would have been like, no, that's, you have kind of just run roughshod over a constitutional foundation, said something completely opposite to what, said it says something opposite to what it actually says, and that would have brought us to a bit of a crisis, because it's clearly not true that the treaty has no legal weight, right? The treaty has this societal and constitutional significance that whatever the Privy Council said in 1940, it's just quite obviously false nowadays. So there will be efforts, I think, in the courts to formally acknowledge that, but as it stands, we're not there yet. I think we need to keep ourselves honest. I think there's this need to acknowledge that when we find ourselves drawn into these fights to defend things which we know to be, which we know to fall short of treaty justice, that that's what we're doing. I honestly think that's fine sometimes. I fell down on the side of it's okay to defend this, and actually quite important, because we want it on the record that these things matter. We want future governments to know that they should bring these things back, although not exactly the same, they should do better. And this is about child protection system. There are children and families, Māori children and families, whose lives are better off for these half-assed provisions. So we can't lose sight of the human consequences of at least making things a bit better. I think that's important work. Sometimes we're just mitigating the damage, but that's still important. But we should call it that. We should know that what we're doing sometimes is mitigating the damage, locking in the progress we've made, even though it feels meager. Because keeping ourselves honest in that way, I think, keeps our eyes set on the horizon where it should be. I think we need to push for constitutional transformation. Some of you will have heard of the Matiki Mai report, which I still think is the most clear-sighted articulation of what it might look like to change our constitutional arrangements to truly honour te tiriti, maybe for the first time. Work on ideas like Matiki Mai continues, and I would encourage anyone to look that up if it's not something you've ever heard of. And this last one, I know this comes a little bit out of left field, but becoming abolitionists. It's not, I've increasingly been interested, and I still don't even know if I can pin my colours to the mast yet, but interested in abolitionist ways of thinking in issues like criminal justice and child protection, because I think they help us think more structurally about underlying problems. So abolitionism and child protection, for example, which sounds like a radical idea, it's basically just the idea that continually reforming a harmful child protection system actually just perpetuates the damage because it upholds the legitimacy of that system in the long term. And as a result, we should abolish that system. Abolition doesn't have to look like burning it down overnight. It probably looks like a long-term effort to build community-based structures which take the place of those, in this case, state agencies. It's not that I have really firm views on that that's the perfect way to address that problem. It's that that feels like a much more constructive way to think structurally about the problem and to think about the underlying problems and to really hone in on how we might do something significantly different instead of just this incremental cycle of reform which never really solves the underlying problem. Māori children have been overrepresented in the child protection system for about 40 years, and we only really know that because that's when we started counting. Efforts at reform, though some of them have been useful, have never solved the underlying problem. So I put become abolitionists question mark on the screen, and interpret that however you like, and you'll all be experts in your fields. It's just to encourage us to kind of keep coming back to underlying problems and asking ourselves how we avoid these cycles that we find ourselves in, where we look at incremental change as positive, but then 50 years later, have not got to where we hoped we would get. I like to end this on a slightly more positive note, so I think, I mean, that's the end. the more positive note is that I think we've seen people become interested in Te Tiriti in the last 3 years in ways that have been fairly unprecedented. That, I mean, this talk, that exhibition, people care about this stuff, and I think that has been really heartening. I heard someone reflect that the difference between this foreshore and seabed hikoi and Te Hikoi mō Te Tiriti was that non-Māori turned up. And there's this momentum for honouring Te Tiriti that I think can't be put back in the tube, and that gives me real hope. And I think the moment we're in is a challenging one, but will pass. And the reason it will pass is because there are thousands and thousands of us that will make it pass. But that is cause for optimism more than it is for despair. So that's me. Happy to chat. Love to wānanga. Any questions? And thank you for coming. Kia ora.